Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
Oh,
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay, today our podcast is titled, Are Reparations a Shakedown Strategy? And we're trying to wait for our board to catch up with us to play the audio. But if you got any thoughts, 619-768-2945, all reparations, a shakedown strategy. So we want to present at least two or three points of view on this. But like I said, I'm waiting for my board to go through its thing. While we're waiting on that, once again, 619-768-2945, that's the call-in number. If you have any ideas, suggestions on any topic that you want covered, give us a call. You can make some suggestions. Matter of fact, we might be able to fit you in on this podcast. Just give us a call. 619-768-2945, and we can take the call on air or off the air. And man, this is one of these days, I guess. Some days, most days, the board operates smoothly, but a small amount of handful times of the year, we have what I call slight technical difficulty. So right now, okay, I see my mic's open. I don't know how much of this you guys have heard. Anyway, today, just in case you didn't hear me, today's podcast is titled, Are Reparations a Shakedown Strategy? That's the question of the day. And we got some audio to play, but we got to wait for the board to sort of cooperate. Today is running kind of slow. And as I stated before, I don't know who heard me or who didn't, because the mic took a long time, longer than usual. It's automatic. It pops right open. So if I repeat myself, I'm repeating myself. All right, here we go. All right, so today's question, this is the title of our podcast, Are Reparations a Shakedown Strategy? Let's play the first audio on this topic.
Welcome back to Black News Tonight. Yvette Carnell, the president of American Descendants of Slavery Advocacy Foundation, will discuss her organization's take on the payment due to Black Americans for over a century and a half. So much to be said about this idea of reparations. And it really comes down in many ways to whether you think Black folk deserve to have the damage done repaired. And there are many people at the forefront of this movement, but there's probably no movement more powerful, more vocal, and more influential in the conversation about reparations in the United States than that of ADOS. It's controversial, it's debated, it's contested, but it's absolutely one of the most important organizations going on. And so we wanted to have one of the founders of the organization, Yvette Carnell, join us here on Black News tonight. Yvette, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
Talk to me, first of all, about the current reparation policy proposals that are on the table. We see locally based things like in Evanston, Illinois. We see conversations about broader proposals. What's your sense of what the current policy landscape is?
Well, I see Evanston actually as a problem, because what you see is that there were money suggested for reparations, like $250K, but that money, first of all, it's a pittance. It's hardly anything. And second of all, it was merely a suggestion. It wasn't actually an allotment. So in terms of what reparation has to be, it has to be a national project, because it was America that did this. It wasn't just local communities. It was America. And so we have to start at the federal level, and we can do local ordinances like we've seen or we're going to see in Louisville and other places, but we can't allow people to kind of skirt this issue and do articles and say, well, we're doing a great thing. We're doing this thing in Evanston. And when you look at Evanston, it's not reparations. It's just a suggestion. We need real money, real wealth, because wealth was plundered and wealth must be repaid.
So talk to me about that claim right there. Wealth is plundered. Wealth must be repaid. That is the fundamental argument of reparations for most folk, myself included. But a lot of times where we get stuck is the details of what kind of plunder we're talking about, what kind of money it takes to repair the damage done, who gets it, and how they get it. So talk to me a little bit about ADOS's policy vision as it pertains to reparations.
Well, the ADOS Advocacy Foundation, we are committed to cash payments. And we are committed to cash payments to a specific group of people, right? And those are American descendants of slavery. Now, we have a transformative Black agenda that includes all Black people. But in terms of reparations, those are the people that built the country and have been systemically, methodically oppressed since then. So you have to have a method not only for cash payments but for programs to protect that wealth, because you can give wealth to a group of people and then that money is plundered by white supremacy and super capitalists who would like nothing more than to take it away from us. So we have to have certain protections But we absolutely have to have cash payments, and this absolutely has to be a federal government initiative in terms of how we do this and how we have outlays and appropriations and things of that nature. It has to happen that way.
Cash payments, how much are we talking?
I like to talk about it as a down payment. I don't like to talk about it because I always say it this way. It takes a lot more time to heal a wound than it takes to inflict a wound. And America has been inflicting a wound for 400 years plus. So it's going to take longer than that to actually heal that wound and close the racial wealth gap, which we like to call the lineage wealth gap. It's going to take longer than that. So I like to call it a down payment. But I think we're talking about at least $20 trillion. That's where we are. Down payment.
$20 trillion. So, and it's an interesting number when you think about what happened during the pandemic, when American capitalism was on the brink, when Trump's presidency was looking shaky, when the heads of multinational corporations were like, what are we going to do? They found $1 trillion real quick for America, right? So the idea of not being able to recover $20 trillion is somewhat less plausible than it was before, because there was a time people, you almost sounded like Dr. Evil saying anything with a T in it, right? But now, that amount of money doesn't sound crazy anymore to people. But for the person who asks, how do we get that money? Where does it come from? How do you sustain a budget? How do you sustain an economy while giving $20 trillion to a 13% of the people, really less than 13% of the people, if you're talking about ADOS lineage, right? How do you do that? What do you say to that person?
Well, I say to everybody, I'm not mandating or demanding that everything happen at one time. I'm not demanding that. This is a project, and this is a formidable project. We actually have to have processes in place. So if we want to start the project and say we have $2 trillion this year, and we have $1 trillion next year, and we have $3 trillion, we can do that. But the problem in America isn't how, because everybody found a way to give Guam reparations, even though it wasn't on the level of ADOS. Everybody found a way to give Japanese Americans reparations, even though it's not on the level of American descendants of slavery. The problem that we have is not how do we do this. The problem that we have is people who don't believe that we should do this. And so I'm more than willing to enter into negotiations and conversations with people who are asking about the how, because the how is something we can figure out. This doesn't have to be, listen, you all, this country did this in a multi-generational way, and we can fix this in a multi-generational way. It doesn't have to all happen today, but it has to happen. And we can enter into that conversation with people of goodwill who want to see this happen. The problem that America has is that there are not enough people. And Martin Luther King Jr. said this himself about even liberals who just kind of tolerate us rather than want the best for us or want justice for us. We need to deal with those people and have an honest conversation with them, because I can figure out the how. The $20 trillion doesn't have to happen all in 2020, 2021, or 2022. Or 2023, we can figure out a process, but it has to happen, and people have to be willing and have the will to do it.
One of the things that ADOS gets criticized the most for, and I've been critical of you, and you know this, I've told you directly, is the conversations that often emerge from people who identify as ADOS around nativism. Right, there often becomes a discourse that emerges online from people with the ADOS hashtag, and I'm using that language very carefully because you've said to me before, that ain't us, right? You know, the people may use the hashtag, that don't mean they represent us. But is there any room for a conversation, in your estimation, around how ADOS and its sort of commitment to talking about descendants of slavery may alienate people who come from other parts of the continent, may undermine a Pan-African agenda, or may kind of replicate, whether it's through the American flag imagery or through constantly talking about a certain kind of lineage, almost replicate a certain kind of American nationalism?
Well, you know, I think we have to make a sort of delineation, right? There's a difference between nationalism and nativism. We're proud of the country that we built. We're proud of the slaves who built the country. We are absolutely proud of our freedom struggle through Jim Crow, mass incarceration. We're proud that we're still here. So what I would say is we are absolutely have a right to be proud of what we built, right? The same way that a Jamaican American is absolutely proud of their history of coming out of slavery. The same way a Haitian is absolutely proud of Toussaint Louverture. We're proud in the same way, and you have to let us have that. We are a specific ethnic lineage. That's who we are. Now, there have been a lot of diaspora wars, but let me say this. A lot of those wars were not started by us. And a lot of those wars, we were defending ourselves. People call me the granddaughter of a cotton picker, right? People call me all sorts of names because I come from sharecroppers. And the problem that I have with a lot of Pan-Africanists is that they will look at me and say, oh, my gosh, you have people behaving in ways that are unproductive. And I want to say you have a lot of people who are behaving in ways that are white supremacist. They are behaving in ways where they co-sign white supremacy. We saw on CNN somebody say something, an anchor said something about America's the greatest country. I could never have done this in another country. Meanwhile, we as ADOS see this. We see what America has done to us. And we see that a lot of people are not very respectful of not only what we have endured, but the pathway where we have opened up to them to come here. If it wasn't for us and our freedom struggle, there would be no black and brown people here. And so we see a lot of disrespect coming our way. So I think the people who criticize us need to also criticize the people who disparage us as well. I only see criticism coming in our direction, and that's a problem for me.
I think that's fair. So let's stipulate for a minute that there's a lot of outside criticism coming towards you that's unfair. And what do you say, though, about the criticisms that are being levied towards ADOS for these ideas around sort of being anti-immigrant, sort of not just sort of having critique of Pan-Africanism, but almost deriding it? I mean, again, maybe all of this isn't part of the fundamental ideology, but it certainly plays out in the kind of primary space where ADOS conversations are having, which is online, as much of our conversations are for everybody. How do you think that it's gotten unwieldy because it's online and because you can't have you can't control who hashtags it? Do you feel like the messaging hasn't been clear, or do you think that this is just part and parcel of how this kind of politics go?
Well, I think you're right on. There have been people who just throw the hashtag in because they want clout, and they do that on Clubhouse, they do that on Twitter, they do it on social media, everywhere. They just want clout. I'm going to say I'm ADOS, but I'm going to bring in some stuff from other people who are not ADOS, and I'm going to just throw it, right, at immigrants. I'm going to throw it at black immigrants. I'm going to disparage them. That has happened, but that's not a part of what we're doing in terms of our organization. What we have said is that, listen, we are absolutely interested in organizing with people who are black immigrants and people who are black American but come from immigrant backgrounds. But we have to organize with a certain kind of foundation, right? We have to have the same kind of politics. I'm not opposed to someone who comes from somewhere else who comes here. We have to have the same politics, though. And I do think there has been disparaging, right, on both sides. But what we're trying to do in terms of the ADOS Advocacy Foundation is move to a place to where if you have our politics, we have a lot in terms of our agenda for anti-discrimination, right? So if you are a black person in America, you still benefit from our agenda. So like-minded people we would like to pull in here. We do have a critique of Pan-Africanism. And we say that, like, in terms of, and I think it was Nikki Giovanni who said something similar, everybody has to be responsible for their corner of the world. And in this corner, ADOS is most responsible. And we will support you with whatever you want to do in Ghana, whatever you want to do in Nigeria. But we have to be responsible with what happened here, because I feel like Pan-Africanism has been like a feel-good kind of opium for black people that has not netted anything in terms of real political advancement. And so I think we should all, and I'm not talking just about ADOS, I think all black people should look locally, look to your state government, your sovereign nation in terms of where your advocacy begins. Because if you can't get reparations and voting rights in America, I know doggone well you're not going to get police reform in Nigeria.
All right. I got to go, but I want to bring you back because I want to really unpack this conversation about Pan-Africanism, because that's probably where you and I are going to separate just a little bit, among other things. So make sure you come back. Hopefully Tone can make it as well, and we can continue to have this conversation about reparations. And our commitment here at Black News Tonight is to talk about reparations from a variety of voices. We are not going, and we did this one time, and we ain't going to do it again. I'm not going to have people here who oppose reparations instead, because I don't want to normalize that idea when most black people support reparations. Instead, what we want to do is have multiple voices from the reparations community to talk about various ways that we can achieve the end of getting black folk what they deserve, which is reparations. Yvette Carnell, thank you so much for joining me. Everybody, stay with me. We got much more coming up on Black News Tonight.
one particular video came across my attention, and it was with O'Shea Duke Jackson. And O'Shea was doing a panel, and the title of the video was titled, Are Women Attracted to Men Like R. Kelly? And he also had on there, I think it's Alan Roger Curry, and he's pretty good too. And shout out to both of them, O'Shea and Alan Rogers. And on this particular panel, he had with him Man of Tomorrow, Cole, Irene Yvette, some other gentleman I can't remember, and of course Super Sly 75. And, you know, Irene said something that was a little touchy for some of the brothers. And I like how some of the brothers handled it. They did. They addressed it. They moved on with it and kept it pushing. But one particular brother, shout out to Super Sly 75, said, no, no. Let me show you brothers how you put the handle this shit. And Sly did a classic Super Sly 75. Now, I watched the thing, and, you know, I watched the video, and I had to smirk about it, but I kind of understood where Irene was coming from, you know, because a lot of brothers, they were talking about, well, a few of the brothers mentioned legal ages, and I think that kind of rubbed her the wrong way, and I think she doesn't really understand how men talk, and I think that's something that men and women should understand, is that brothers are going to say some stuff that women are not going to like, and men are going to say some stuff that women are not going to like. If I said that right. Men and women are going to say things that each other's not going to too much appreciate. But sometimes you got to listen very carefully and understand what the other one's really saying. Understand, I've said this in the past, is that men and women use the same words, but it's not the same language. And I think the thing is that she didn't understand is that many of the brothers do agree that, you know, child molestation or child, whatever you want to call it, when it comes down to R. Kelly, it's not rape, but it's more like statutory rape. But let's just say having sex with young girls is, you know, it's one of those things that kind of, it kind of bothers me a little bit because I think about the mindset of a young girl, you know, being an older brother with sisters and at the same time, at my own age, even talking to someone who's like 21 years old is it's an adult kid. Let's just call it what it is. They haven't matured yet. Mentally haven't matured. And I will say, in my own personal opinion, I do believe that women, if it was left to me, shouldn't be seen as adults until 21. Just my opinion. And I think y'all already understand why. You know, they still have this young mindset, and it's slowly maturing into an adult mindset. And I do believe that sometimes that can be taken advantage of by older men, especially much older men. Not to say R. Kelly, but much older men, especially when you see someone who's like 21 with somebody who's a man who's 50 dating girls who are 21. Even though it's legal, it's kind of funny. But I will say this here. I kind of understand it from an instinctive way when it comes down to men and women. Understand that Irene, she's looking at it from the standpoint that she has children.
I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. I don't want nobody give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. Do you hear me? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. Don't give me integration, give me true communication. Don't give me sorrow, I want equal opportunity to live tomorrow. Give me schools, give me better books, so I can read about myself and gain my true look. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get them myself. Do you hear me now? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get them myself. As hard as we can, we don't want no sympathy, we just wanna be a man. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. Do you hear me? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Evanson. Open up the door. I'm a gentleman myself. We got talents we can use on our side of town. Let's get our heads together and bend it up from the ground. When some of us make money, we forget about our people. Forget about a honey. Forget about a honey. Do you hear now? Do you hear?
Cause we gonna get this thing together, and you got to care for.
I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door. Open up.
James Brown, I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door and I'll get it myself. Today's podcast is titled, Are Reparations a Shakedown Strategy? I'm going to take it one step further than James. I don't need you to open up the door. I'll build the door myself. I'll build the door, frame in the building, and I'll create my own opportunity. Let's look at the definition of civil rights. Because basically, civil rights, in my opinion, the way I see it, civil rights is your reparations. Now, it's up to the individual and their imagination of what they're going to do with their civil rights. You know, you got people in the social services office, they exercise their civil rights to go to the social services office and get those services. Nothing wrong with that. Then you've got people like Bob Johnson and his first, his ex-wife. They had a civil right to start Black Entertainment Television and become billionaires. That was their civil right, and which was available to anybody. But they acted on it. Jay-Z, former drug dealer, he had a civil right. It was illegal when he did it, dealing drugs, but he had a civil right to stop doing that and become a rapper and become a billionaire doing hip-hop, because hip-hop is an unregulated industry. Kanye West, say what you want about him, he had a civil right to get involved with hip-hop and become a billionaire. I think his net worth is like $6 billion. Everybody I'm naming are first, all Black, all first-generation billionaires in this lifetime. People are not 100 years old. Kanye and what's his name? Jay-Z, they're not even 50 years old. How you using your silver? So, now, according to me, reparations looks different to different people. Kanye West got his reparations through hip-hop. Jay-Z got his reparations his way. Bob Johnson got his reparations through Black Entertainment Television. And so does his ex-wife. I think she owns part of a WNBA team. She's one of the owners of a WNBA team and, upscale hotels. All right. Kamala Harris, she got her reparations in part by being VP of the United States. She worked for it. She exercised her civil right. I'm looking at, that's the common denominator. 24 hours in a day. There are 24 hours in a day available to everybody, regardless of their race, creed, color, religion, or whatever. 24 hours a day. Are you going to sit and bitch and moan and complain for those 24 hours that you're awake? Or are you going to act? And see, that's why there'll never be anything such thing as really your equality is the 24 hours in a day. That's your equality. That's the only pure metric, in my opinion, that you can use. Anything less than looking at the 24 hours in a day and what you do with those 24 hours a day, then you're counting somebody else's money. Then you're counting somebody else's reparations. Question of the day is, reparations a shakedown strategy.
We've been covering the issue of reparations as it makes headlines across the country. At the congressional level, House Bill H.R. 40 would create a commission to investigate the impact of slavery from 1619 to the present. It's named for the 40 acres and a mule promised to the formerly enslaved after the Civil War. At the state level, California has formed a task force that would study reparations for its black population. And at the local level, Evanston, Illinois approved the Restorative Housing Reparations Program this past March. It began offering qualified black residents $25,000 for repairs or down payments on a home. Across the country, talk about reparations is bigger than ever. Joining me now to separate the hype from the reality is my next guest. He is the co-author of the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Dr. William Darity Jr., thank you for joining me here on Black News Tonight. Talk to me about this word reparations. It's been going around a lot these days, and I'm seeing bills here, some of which are attempting to repair damage done, some of which are attempting to right historical wrongs, some of which are attempting to piece together some kind of fix to structural problems. But the question is it really reparations?
Well, I have a very specific view of reparations, and it's a view that we outlined, Kirsten Mullen and I, in our book, From Here to Equality. We think that reparations must have four components. The first is it must establish who's eligible to receive reparations. And in our argument, we propose that it should be black Americans who have ancestors who were enslaved in the United States. Secondly, the legislation that eventually gets developed should ensure that reparations plays the role of eliminating the racial wealth gap in the United States. The racial wealth gap is the primary and most powerful indicator of the cumulative effects across generations of white supremacy in this country. It would require an expenditure of in the vicinity of $11 to $12 trillion to eliminate that gap. And once we focus on that objective, it becomes clear that many of these other tactics, proposals, plans that people are putting forward to be called reparations really don't function as reparations. The third attribute that a reparations plan ought to have is it should involve direct payments to the eligible recipients. And then fourth and finally, it needs to be a project that's conducted by the federal government for two reasons. First, the federal government is the only level of government that has the capacity to meet the bill. If we took the combined budgets of all the state and local governments in the United States, including Evanston, Illinois, that would come to $3.1 trillion, but the amount that's required to eliminate the racial wealth gap is in excess of $11 trillion. So states and localities can't do it. The federal government can, and we are aware that the federal government can do it, in part because of our recent experience with the funds that were amassed to address the coronavirus crisis very quickly without raising taxes. But the other point that I'd like to make is that the federal government is the culpable party. It's the federal government that bears the legal and authority responsibility for the series of atrocities that black Americans have been subjected to from the period of slavery into the present moment, where we have mass incarceration, police killings of blacks who are unarmed, as well as ongoing discrimination in a variety of areas.
So for you, even if the states had the capacity to produce $11 or $12 trillion to meet reparations, there's another philosophical and moral issue at stake here. You would not support state-based reparations even if the funds were available. Is that accurate?
I would not be so inclined to do so in large measure, because what would happen is I think that states would adopt very different programs. You were talking about the issue concerning states' restoration of control over the abortion, over abortion rights, and that would eliminate kind of a uniform, unified project for reparations. So I think it's important, regardless of whether or not the states had the capacity to do it, that we do this as a federal project. This is a national responsibility.
A national responsibility. What form should this responsibility take? There are many debates not just about whether or not reparations should be given, but what form they should take. Are we talking about a stimulus plan type of check sent out to the descendants of formerly enslaved Africans? Are we talking about free public education? What could reparations look like?
So let me say at the outset that indirect measures like scholarships for education are not going to turn the trick in terms of eliminating the racial wealth gap. It's noteworthy that the median black household head with a college degree has two-thirds of the net worth of the median white household head who never finished high school. So equalizing education or improving educational standards in the black community is not going to turn the trick in terms of addressing the racial wealth gap. And that's what must be the target of a reparations program. And as I mentioned a moment ago, it should be conducted in such a way that direct payments are made to eligible recipients, just in the same way that direct payments were made to eligible recipients under other reparations plans. Whether it was the German government's payments to victims of the Holocaust, or it's the United States government's own payments to Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated during the course of World War II. There's no reason it should be any different for black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
All right, I'm glad you picked that up. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about why it should only be for the U.S. descendants of American slavery, in your opinion. Dr. Darity, stay with me. We've got much more coming up with Black News Tonight. We're talking reparations here, and later in the program, we'll be talking about reparations around the globe. Stay with me. Welcome back to Black News Tonight. We continue our discussion on reparations with Dr. William Darity. Before the break, we talked about reparations and sort of what it would look like, sort of structurally, how it would come out of the federal government, how it could take the form of payments because of the critiques you had of thinking about it as just an educational intervention. All that makes sense to me. One question that comes up to folk, though, is, how do we decide who gets it? There's the logistical challenge of determining who is eligible for reparations based on their origin. But then there's this philosophical question that many people raise, which is, you know, if African people were dropped off in the Caribbean, if African people were dropped off, of course, in the United States, et cetera, why would we develop a reparations plan that is exclusively for the descendants of American slavery here? For example, if someone is a third generation person from the Caribbean, whose parents are from the Caribbean, and they're here right now, and they're experiencing anti-black racism, they're experiencing the structural remnants of slavery, etc. Why should they not be in the reparations discussion?
So they should be in the reparations discussion if they are a third generation individual who intermarried with somebody who is a descendant of persons enslaved in the United States. There's no question that their children would be fully eligible for reparations under the two criteria that Kirsten Mullen and I introduced in our book. The first criteria is a lineage standard. An individual would have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second criterion is an identity standard. So for at least 12 years before the adoption of a reparations plan or the adoption of a study commission for reparations, an individual would have to show that they self-identified as black, Negro, African American, or Afro-American. Now, why would we establish these conditions? Because of the specificity of the experience of black American descendants of U.S. slavery in this particular country. The anchoring event that creates the debt that is owed to that descendant population is the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the 40 acres of land grants that they were promised as restitution for their years of bondage. And at the same time, the federal government was giving 160-acre land grants to 1.5 million white families in the Western territories that set up the foundation for their wealth accumulation across generations, while black Americans were denied the same opportunity. And so the consequences are evident today in terms of the current racial wealth gap. And that's something that we must address through a reparations program. And it should be specifically for the descendants of the individuals who were denied the 40 acres. You know, keep in mind, you've been talking about the situation with respect to the German atrocities that were conducted against the Herero and the Nama people in southern Africa. And they are bringing a claim before Germany, and that's a claim that is specifically theirs. They are not including black Americans in their claim, nor should they. Similarly, in the context of the Congo, the Congolese are making claims on the Belgian government, and it's appropriate that they do so. So individuals who are more recent black immigrants to the United States certainly have a reparations claim, but they have a reparations claim on the nations that colonized and enslaved their people. They do not have a claim on the United States government.
All right. There's a movement that has emerged in recent years out of this premise, right, that we should exclusively focus on reparations in the United States on those descendants of American slavery. We see the ADOS movement. We've also seen more recently the FBA movement, Foundational Black Americans. Where do you stand in relation to both of those movements?
Well, I agree with two premises. And the first premise is that there is a uniqueness to the experience of individuals whose families have their origins in slavery that was practiced in the United States. And second, that is the community that merits reparations from the United States government. So those are the two premises that I agree with. I think there are lots of other things that some members of those movements say that I don't necessarily agree with. There's another group that's worth mentioning who's involved in this, or two others. One is a group that calls themselves the Descendants of Freedmen, and another is the National Assembly on reparations for persons who have ancestors who were enslaved in the United States. And I fundamentally agree with those two principles that I just mentioned, and I think those are principles that are shared by all of these groups.
You were often associated, though, specifically with the ADOS group, with the work of Antonio Moore and Yvette Carnell. Are you
either one of them would associate me with their current activity.
not anymore. Yeah, that was going to be my question. What happened? It seemed like they were at one point you all were working together. It seemed like, and more recently, I've seen critiques and even allegations that you're sort of trying to undermine or co-opt the movement. What happened there?
I really, really don't know. It's somewhat of a mystery to me, and I'm still reeling a little bit because I think I've been consistent and in being fully committed to the cause of reparations.
Are you hopeful at this moment that we will see a pivot? You know, I've looked at this issue for a very long time, not in my professional scholarly work as you have, but I've certainly been an organizer and an activist around this, and we've been talking reparations for decades. We've always wanted it. We've always hoped for it. But from my perspective, this seems like the first time that there's a public appetite for it, that we're not getting rejected out of hand in the public policy arena. Are you hopeful that we'll see reparations in our lifetime?
Well, I'm not sure if I'll live long enough to see it happen, but I think that we're in a position that's more propitious than any that I've ever experienced while I've been on this planet. And I think it's a debt that's owed that has been overdue for 156 years. So the question is whether or not the climate is more suitable today for making the move towards full and comprehensive reparations. And I'll say this, here are some grounds for optimism. In the year 2000, about 4% of white Americans were willing to indicate that they supported reparations for black Americans. By the year 2018, that percentage had risen to about 16%. And today, the most recent surveys that I've seen indicate that percentage is closer to 30%. So still not in a position that would lead us to be able to enact a reparations program at the congressional level, but a far better situation than the one that existed at the start of the current century, and one that's promising about prospects for reparations becoming a reality, hopefully in the near future.
Absolutely. Well, we keep fighting, we keep pushing, and hopefully we'll see a victory. And when the final story on reparations is told, and I do believe we will be victorious in this struggle, your work will certainly be a key part of that historical conversation. Sandy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Everybody, all right, make sure you join the conversation. We want to hear from you. So head over to our BNC Instagram and Twitter pages. Let us know how you feel. Also visit our website, bnc.tv. Also, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube page to check out clips from the show.
This podcast is titled, Are Reparations a Shakedown Strategy? 619-768-2945. You know, as I was listening to the last audio, we're going to institute something here on It's My House. I don't know if we're going to start off doing it once a month or once a week. And I'm playing with two titles right now, 40 Acre Day or Reparations Day. I don't know which title I'm going to use yet. But here's how it's going to go. Matter of fact, we're going to start instituting this starting the first week in September. That's next month. Is the whole idea is to, once again, I believe reparation comes in two forms. Fundamental operating tools. One, everybody's got 24 hours in a day. We're all equal when it comes to time. Time is an asset. Number two, civil rights. At least in this country, you have a civil right to essentially do what you want to do. So on, like I said, I don't know what I'm going to call it yet, Reparations Day or 40 Acre Day. I haven't decided yet, but we're going to start this the first week of next month. And essentially, this is how it goes. The idea is to at least once a month, for those who can, for others, once a week, you know, if you can pull that off, just at least 1 acre of land and continue to do that until you acquire 40 acres of land. Now, I'm betting that is dramatically a lot less easier to go out and exercise your civil right to buy 1 to 40 acres or more of land in a course of a year. Some of you might take 4 years, some of you might take 10 years. But the thing is, we're going to have a platform here where we might start off once a month, but I wanted to get it at least 1 day a week where we're actively purchasing and hearing people's testimonies that they've gone out and they bought maybe not even an acre of land, but maybe they bought a quarter acre of land or a half acre. But they keep on going. The goal of the club is to purchase 40 acres of land, because I'm sick and tired of hearing these excuses. Well, they promised us 40 acres, but then they took it back. Or, I think it's totally ridiculous and a waste of time to expect an act of Congress. No, the equality is, right now, there are 24 hours in a day for everybody living and breathing on the planet. Bill Gates has got the same 24 hours in a day, if everybody listening to this podcast right now, Jeff Bezos has the same 24 hours in a day as the Skid Row bum. Kanye West, Master P, Dr. Dre, Beyonce, all these people have the same 24 hours a day as everybody who is living and breathing on the planet. That's your equality right there. Anything less than that, you are counting somebody else's money. And what's that? One of the Ten Commandments. When you start coveting somebody else's stuff, you automatically blind yourself to the opportunities that you're standing in the midst of. What do you call it? Your anchor's a diamond. Question of the day is, are reparations a shake? Now, so I'm looking at what a lot of these people are trying to get money out of the federal government. They're basically trying to shake down the people with the biggest purse. I'm going to play two more audios, and then we're going to take calls here at 619-768-2945. The next two stories are about people who started out as slaves here in the United States. They started off legally as slaves. They bought their freedom, and then they got that. Now, they were slaves now. If anybody deserves reparations, there's a person who was legally classified as a slave. Right here in the United States. But they bought their freedom, exercising their civil rights, and then they started their own township. So their reparations came in the form of them buying their own freedom and then buying the land and then starting their own town. And they're both black. And they didn't wait on the government to do all of that.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
We're located at a site called New Philadelphia. New Philadelphia was founded by Frank McWhorter in 1836. The town no longer exists today. If you look behind me, there's lots of prairie grass behind me. And we're here with the National Science Foundation grant to rediscover New Philadelphia.
New Philadelphia is just remarkably significant in that it was founded by Free Frank McWhorter, who had purchased himself out of slavery, came here, planned this town in advance, legally founded it, and then it grew as a multiracial town in a region that was filled with racial strife. His mother was West African. His father was likely George McWhorter, a Scots-Irish planter, who was also his owner. And he's born in 1777 in South Carolina. In his 20s and 30s, moves with George McWhorter to Kentucky, where George McWhorter was setting up a new plantation in that area.
He was the son of his owner and actually had a managerial role on the farm in Kentucky and was able to hire himself out to mine saltpeter and then eventually to become a landowner himself.
He sees the developing Illinois frontier and the availability of land. He has purchased the freedom for his wife, his own freedom. He has a few grown children. And in about the 1820s, he begins to focus on purchasing land here in Illinois and now moving his family to Illinois.
What he wanted to do was to create a town, and he divided it up into 144 lots, and he began to sell lots in this town. And from the proceeds of selling that land, he was able to purchase members of his family out of slavery.
You know, it's just incredible. A man who spent 40 years working and very, very hard and saving every penny, being very frugal, being very clever.
In his lifetime, he purchases the freedom of 16 members of his entire family out of bondage. For a cash outlay in the currency of that day, it was about $14,000 in 19th century funds. If you calculate that for today, he was able to accumulate and expend over $300,000 to purchase 16 members of his family. So it's both a story of incredible freedom and his ability to overcome the adversity of slavery, but then also just a brilliant man. He saw the opportunities of starting a mining operation at one point that helped in that process. He saw the opportunity of moving to Illinois and new land and settlement and coming here in Pike County, Illinois, where he had moved.
New Philadelphia grew slowly. In 1855, there were about 58 people here. In 1865, there were about 160 people here.
This population peaks in the census records in 1865 with about 160 residents, 30 households, several merchants. There was a cabinet maker, two shoemakers, blacksmiths, a wainwright, a wheelwright. There was a Baptist preacher in town.
What's interesting about New Philadelphia to me is that during the course of its history, it was a biracial town. That maybe 30 to 35% of the people were classified as African Americans and the rest were classified as white during the town's history. And so while there was a hierarchy based on race out here, there tended to be more cooperation and barn building and helping each other out. People had to survive and they had to work with each other to survive. And that's one of the reasons why I think there was less tension here than other places.
We've never found a record of any major turmoil or problems, and the blacks and whites lived here together peacefully before the Civil War, 20 miles from Missouri, which was a slave state. They helped each, I mean, they lived together, they worshiped together, they intermarried. So I think it's something we can all learn a lesson from.
To call it New Philadelphia, we've always assumed that it was the new city of brotherly love. I mean, that's what the family tradition is, that it was a conscious decision to say that we want to rebuild America anew, right up next to slavery, and white people came and lived here. So it apparently, for some time, it worked.
And I suspect the European Americans who moved here were of like mind. I think the story and the intent of the founder and also of the residents here would have been known by word of mouth. So that you probably had a town of individuals who were comfortable with that notion of a multiracial community. They probably realized the risks of it, and they knew the tensions going on surrounding them. This was an area completely rife with racial strife. Elijah Lovejoy is shot dead 50 miles south of here in the 1830s. He's an abolitionist and has his own printing press, and he's shot dead as a mob is burning down his house in the printing press. A town called Griggsville is just only about 10 miles from New Philadelphia. There's race riots there in the 1830s, 1840s. So this is by no means a frontier area free of racial strife, and yet he's able to accomplish all these remarkable features of creating an integrated town that is good purposely and explicitly to obtain funds to buy his family freedom.
We're fairly certain that an abolitionist community of free black people who were actively getting their families out of Missouri and Kentucky to come and live here would not have been something that would be unknown to the abolitionist Underground Railroad network.
Everybody knew when you got to New Philadelphia, you had a pair of shoes and a horse and directions or a guide to get you to Canada, which, you know, that's a wonderful story. Frank made such a wonderful contribution to the whole notion of freedom.
It's very hard for archaeologists to find the actual material remains of the Underground Railroad because it's basically individuals escaping, staying in known structures that are used as a barn. It's not as if you create special spaces for it. But there's a tremendous oral history and then documentary history of the area that gives us every reason to believe that New Philadelphia was an active participant in the Underground Railroad.
After the American Civil War, there's also a migration from the South where we see a lot of African Americans moving into Illinois and Hadley Township and also into New Philadelphia. And that's probably the reason why the town's population peaked in 1865.
In 1869, the town's bypassed by the railroad and the population begins to decline. So that by 1885, we see in the court records that part of the town was declassified as a town and the land reverted for general agricultural use because people had moved away and now it was basically being pulled back into general farming use. We're exploring the reasons for the bypass of the town by the railroad, and we have not yet found any of the traditional reasons of topography made a reason to avoid the town. And it may be that that fits within we're going to find that that fits within the story of racial impacts, that there may have been some sort of racial bias of the actual route of the railroad, and that's an ongoing research question for us.
The early settlers dug a cellar hole, they built a cabin around it, and after the town was abandoned, they'd start filling it with trash. And the trash is what we're after. We're interested in other people's garbage because that gives us a clue about what people are buying, what they're consuming, their access to markets, their dietary habits.
The more households we can excavate, compare the data, compare the material culture, the building styles that we can infer of architecture, the richer picture we'll have of the history of the town.
We've been here about 4 weeks now.
We found a lot of glass, just flat glass and ceramic. And then in the past couple of days, we found a key. So that was a really cool find.
We just found a small cylindrical piece that could be a game piece or a doll over by where Jason and Hillary are working.
And we've also found there's, you can't see it anymore, but there used to be, like, some ash. And so one idea that we have is that it might have been, like, a fireplace. We've been finding a lot of burned bones and a lot of animal bones over in this area over here. And that's really where we found the majority of our artifacts.
And once the artifacts are washed and sorted out in the field, we bring them in here in drying trays to dry, and then we put them in artifact bags and take them to the museum where we'll catalog them. There's porcelain feet that we think they're from a doll. We found some other fragments. We haven't tried to put them all together yet.
The last couple of days, we'll be filling everything back in, which is kind of sad, but, you know, we have to do it, be as non-destructive as possible. And then we're all moving to Springfield, to the Illinois State Museum Research and Collections Department, where we will be analyzing all of the artifacts we've been pulling out and hopefully getting a clearer picture of what it is that happened here.
I love it. I think it's fascinating. It's part of history, and we can learn something new from them. Every little piece they take out, we can learn something.
It's good to see the community also so interested in a project like this. It just makes you feel that Free Frank actually did, not only did he inspire others around him, I'm sure, during his time, but for years to come, his story is still going to live on, and through us finding artifacts and researching and hopefully displaying some of them, people who may not have known about the story may learn and get something from it.
It's almost that this is a cross-section of America. You have just tons of people living here, and it's probably not a racial utopia. People are probably terribly harmonious. There's conflict here, and days are tough, and breaking the sod is still as hard here in New Philadelphia as it is anywhere else. But this is a whole slice, a cross-section of America at large, taken down to about 40-some acres. And so understanding this little place helps us to build a broader picture of what America could be.
It's just such a great story. You feel like you're really learning something about one of the untold American heroes.
He negotiated and purchased the freedom of himself, his wife, other kids. He came here and assisted the Underground Railroad. And he sent descendants to fight in the Civil War. So it seems to me, Frank and his family fought for freedom every way you could.
His gravesite, as a matter of fact, is one of three in the state. It's on the National Registry of Historic Places, Abraham Lincoln, and then Douglas, the senator that he debated. And the third is Frank McWhirter. So he's certainly a part of the memory in the state. I think he's in a good place. He's in a very good place.
He's just a phenomenal individual who should be in every history book that students are reading in our grade schools, in our primary schools. He should be there when you read about, Abraham Lincoln. It's individuals like Free Frank who should be part of the story, too.
Well, I think the main thing is we can learn is that America is possible. The country is possible. I think that's the message. America is possible. That's the message of Free Frank.
Known to this nation as one of the first established all-black towns, Mound Bayou, Mississippi, founded in 1887, incorporated in 1898 by former slaves, for decades has been known for its rich culture and African-American history. I'm Danny Lewis, and join us today as we visit Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Well, I need to pull up a chair. For those of you that just joined us today, we're here in the office of Mayor Darrell Johnson in historical Mount Bayou, Mississippi, one of the first celebrated African-American municipality in this entire country. Mayor Johnson, thank you for having us today, and welcome to the Talk of the Town.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, Mayor, take us back to the beginning, the Mount Bayou story.
Well, Mount Bayou has a great and a rich history. And I always say that African-American history really has not been told until you really tell our story. Because we're so deeply rooted into African-American history. There were men that stayed on this most very successful plantation called Hurricane and Briar Plantation, who ended up running the plantation because Jefferson Davis' brother, Joe Davis, who owned the plantation and along with Jefferson Davis, opted out to go along with this Robert Owen plan that says, you know, this utopian society, let these guys get their education. And that's what they adopted that. And so they allowed those guys to get education. And those guys on that plantation exceeded everybody in education. They studied so strongly. And they ended up being, I say, geniuses. They were agriculture geniuses. They were entrepreneur geniuses. They were engineers. So they were able to draw up cities and do the types of things that so much so that was one of the most successful plantations at that time. And it was I.T. Montgomery's daddy who ended up running that plantation, and he was revered to be such a strong, intelligent man that those guys ended up coming to Mount Bayou, and later on, those young men, Isaac T. Montgomery and Benjamin Green, and they founded some swamp land and turned it into a town, and here we are in Mount Bayou, Mississippi.
So this actual town was founded in what year?
1887 it was founded. It was a swamp full of, infested with bears, mosquitoes, and all type of wild animals, but the train ran through it, and the train sold them this property, and they turned this into a great city.
So now tell us a little bit about the founding father on paper, Mr. Montgomery.
Mr. Montgomery actually was, Montgomery and his cousin, Benjamin T. Green, were noted to be the founders of Mount Bayou. And they actually were very smart. To get people to come here, they actually interviewed them. And they wanted to bring people that wanted to do something. And so they got these people that wanted to do something after Reconstruction to come into Mound Bayou, this part of Mississippi, which is a Mississippi Delta, which is probably one of the most racist areas they could do. But they came here, and this rich alluvial soil, they raised cotton probably better than anybody else in the surrounding areas, that white farmers as well would come and try to bring their cotton into Mound Bayou. These were people that I say were geniuses that really wanted to show what African Americans can do.
So now, in knowing that this town or this city has a history of producing a lot of success of a lot of different well-known African-Americans, such as Mega Evers, to be one.
Mega Evers, we have people that have come from Mound Bayou. Booker T. Washington used to come into Mound Bayou. He mentored the people, and he ended up having a bank, one of the first banks, African-American banks in the area. And Mega Evers, Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who was Mega Evers' mentor, and Mega Evers worked for Dr. T.R.M. Howard. A lot of people don't know he's one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. He was the one that spoke at Martin Luther King Sr.'s church, and Rosa Parks was sitting out there, and 4 days later, Rosa Parks said, "I'm not getting up on this bus." He was the man who inspired these people. He was the one who had the fights with J. Edgar Hoover and told him, "You need to come down here to Mississippi and investigate this Emmett Till trial." And because of that, Emmett Till now, his situation is noted for the starting of the civil rights movement. So Mount Bayou is noted for a whole lot that a lot of people don't know about.
Now, we have a modern-day congressman who is actually one of the only black African-American congressman mm-hmm. in the, from the state of Mississippi, Benny Thompson. He has roots here as well.
Well, Benny Thompson married from Mound Bayou. He used to come to Mound Bayou and court London Johnson, whose parents owned one of the local stores here. And he ended up taking London, and that's his
found his sweetie here.
That's exactly right.
And also, you have a brother that's a well-known musician, because the Mississippi Delta is known, obviously, for its rich history and foundation of the blues. A lot of great blues musicians. But your brother, who is a well-known blues musician, is from this area.
He's a drummer, and he's actually the think tank behind the Delta Music Institute in Delta State. And that's the Delta Institute is the one who's bringing the Grammy Museum into to Cleveland, Mississippi. But actually, before the Grammy Museum, before Delta Music Institute, was Joe Eagle and Eagle Academy, which was the think tank. The ones who really started the Delta Music Institute were the ones who got the idea from Joe Eagle, who was mentored by some great people before him.
You have a picture here that I believe has Emmett Till's mother on it. You want to talk a little bit about
that?
Well,
after the murder, which was just a few miles from here, after the murder of Emmett Till, there had to be a safe haven, a safe place where blacks could come dealing with that situation, because at that time, blacks had become fed up with the action that was being taken against blacks by some of the racist people in the area. And Dr. T.R.M. Howard, you know, these people in Mound Bayou were successful at that time. They were celebrating. It was a black sheriff, black mayor, black business owners, black everything here. And then you had all these things that was happening against black people all around. So Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who was the medical director at the hospital here in Mound Bayou, also was a very highly charismatic speaker. And he would go around and speak in different places. He was the one that Mamie Till came and stayed with as he began to spar this investigation of what happened to Emmett Till.
Now, Dr. Howard is on this particular picture, which...
There's Dr. Howard right in the middle with the bow tie on. He's holding on to the arm of Mamie Till. And they stopped and posed for that picture. There's some other people, and I can't remember all the names of the people that's on that picture. But Dr. Howard was one of the ones that even throughout the newspapers, you do a history check, you find out that he sparred openly in the newspaper with J. Edgar Hoover, who he really pushed to come down and do an investigation of what was going on here in Mississippi to black people.
Now, after the Emmett Till situation and this whole thing with Mrs. Till coming to this area and Dr. Howard and all, how did that affect Mound Bayou as a town, as far as its existence? Was it a boost, or was it kind of viewed as a negative impact?
Well, Mound Bayou was
the
place. It was the place where it was a place where they would say that you could not only run from the sheriff, but it was a place where you run for the sheriff. So you would have people that actually, that this was the place that you could come and stop. And so blacks would come here and launch off and do other things to deal with the civil rights era.
Now, Mound Bayou was actually one of the first all African-American towns established in this country,
right.
Along with a place in North Carolina.
Well, Princeville, North Carolina, which is does not have as much of a celebration that we have, did not make the news. Edenville, Florida, which celebrates 1887 like we celebrate 1887. But we are the most celebrated. And we're the most documented African-American city in the country. And a lot of the papers from the New York Times all the way down to some of the local papers wrote about Mound Bayou, and they would say that Mound Bayou is the oldest African-American city in the country.
Now you guys are still predominantly African-American population, if not all.
It's just basically. You can basically say that we're all black still. Maybe a few. But I always say that, you know, and it's no secret. I mean, you could study us and find out that there's still racism, because you don't find many whites wanting to move into a black neighborhood. What is that to say about how whites thinks about blacks? So we don't have a lot of people over the years since 1887 that wanted to move into Mound Bayou, but that were not African American.
So now you guys still have, you have the very first hospital in the Mississippi Delta formed by an all-black staff in 1942, I believe it was.
1942. That hospital was built by the nickels and dimes of people in a secret fraternal order called Knights and Daughters of Tabor across this country. And during that time, there were a lot of secret fraternal orders, because you had to do things in secret. But they opted to build a hospital during that time, and for the first time, blacks could walk into the front door of a hospital in the middle of this racist Mississippi South, and people were able to be taken care of medically right here in Mound Bayou.
Now, as we came through town, I noticed that you guys have a sign that the hospital has been reconstructed, remodeled, and reopened.
That's exactly right. It's now been refurbished, remodeled, what you want to say, and now it's a Taborian Urgent Care Center has been placed into the building, and the building is back up and going now.
Now, you're in your very first term, the third year of your first term as mayor of Mound Bayou, Mississippi. So what are some of the things that you have implemented that's going on now for the city, the growth of this city, and what's in store for the future of Mound Bayou?
Well, for the first few years, I started building foundations, because I knew Mound Bayou, it was very significant in African-American history. And our story needed to be told. The African-American story needed to be told. And I think that Mound Bayou has a very important part in African-American history, so that when we tell our story, the whole African-American story really can be told. Our problem is that whites have been telling our story, and we have not. So one of the things that I'm telling everybody, tell a story and tell the real story so that we all can be proud of who we are. That's one of the things that I'm doing in Mound Bayou. And because of it, we started what we call the Historic Black Towns and Settlement. We've gotten all of the historic black towns that were influenced by Booker T. Washington. We've started an initiative together, and now we're working together to...
Now, just name a few of those, because I'm familiar
again,
with Fed.
Grant. Well, actually, Fed is not a part of this one. We started with five across the country. Grambling, Louisiana, which is the oldest black settlement in Louisiana. Hobson City, Alabama, which is the oldest black in Alabama. Tuskegee, where Booker T. Washington
right.
was. Eatonville, Florida, which is the oldest in Florida. And Princeville, again, we added Princeville, North Carolina, in there. And, of course, Mound Bayou. And so we call ourselves the Fabulous Five, but now it's six. But the point is what we formed is a collaboration, and we're setting up a tourist trail around this whole country. We're pulling ourselves up and saying that these are the places that need to be revered in African American history. So I've done that. I've worked that, and we're working very well. Lately, we just had a summit with the historic with the HBCUs. And the black colleges at Tuskegee just a few weeks ago. And so now we're including the HBCUs in our initiatives as well. But now in Mound Bayou, I'm still pushing that locally. We set our city up today as a tourist place. And I have a vision to see African-American museums in this area.
Now, you made mention to me before we started the show about President Teddy Roosevelt stopping through here on his own private train.
221.
Yeah.
And
in the beginning of the foundation of the city,
yeah.
And speaking very highly.
Well, we know President Theodore Roosevelt, if you look at the history, he had a slight, one of the things that you can hear about Theodore Roosevelt is that he started inviting blacks to the White House. He invited Booker T. Washington to the White House. Of course, he wouldn't do it again after all of the flack that he had behind him inviting Booker T. Washington to the White House. But He revealed what was going on in the black community, and he had to stop at Mound Bayou. And so I say he brought 221 to Mound Bayou, but he got on the back of the train, he made his speech, and he looked up and down the city, and he saw these humongous, majestic homes that had these white picket fences around it. And he said in his speech, and these are 100% Negroes. These are actually 100% Negroes, and they built this place. This is the jewel of the Delta. And that's the name that we coined. What he said, Theodore Roosevelt called us the jewel of the Delta, and we are. We are a jewel in this Mississippi Delta. And he, and again, I was saying that Booker T. Washington came here and helped get a bank started here in Mound Bayou. And so we've had some of the greats here in Mound Bayou as well.
Now, what's the future, or what do you plan for the future
now
of this great city?
Now in Mound Bayou, I think we need to be able to do what the Bible says. When the children of Israel were coming across that sea, and God told them, say, you take stones, and you put those stones there. When your children ask you about it, you can point back to the stone and say, this is what this stone means. Now we have more than stones. We can do museums, and we can tell our story. So now I believe it's time for us to start dealing with museums. I'm looking at a black church museum. I'm looking at a museum that'll tell the story of us coming from Africa all the way to America. See, a lot of people don't know. They didn't just bring people from out of the woods in Africa. They brought kings and queens. They brought people that were very and highly intelligent there, but brought them to a strange land and turned them into slaves. But we need to respect what came from Africa and tell the real story. Talk about how they put us on that boat, but also talk about how we came and were very ingenuous. These people that built the mercantile stores and the ones that built the agriculture on the backs of our folks, this country became great. Cotton was king in the South. And it is what made the Confederacy. When they fly that Confederate flag, a lot of folks get upset. But when they fly that Confederate flag, it says to me that it was our folks who actually bankrolled the fact that they could even make a flag like that. And so what I'm saying, what makes me proud, is that we were the people that made this country great.
Right.
And it was those people that came into Mound Bayou and made Mound Bayou great at that time as well.
Well, Mayor Johnson, we thank you again. We appreciate you for letting us come in. And good luck in the future.
Thank you so very much.
All right.
Keep your eyes on Mound Bayou.
Right here, historical Mound Bayou, Mississippi, the jewel of the Mississippi Delta. You have been on the talk of the town.
Actually, this is a lot of Alphas would like to look at this one. This was the home of Fred and Mariah Miller, but it doesn't exist now. But this home was, he was the third general president of Alpha Phi Alpha. Many A5As know about him, and he stayed right here in Mound Bayou. And then the home of Mayor Booz, and his wife Mary Booz was a National Republican committee woman. A lot of people don't know that blacks were Republican back in the day. And Mound Bayou also was an education center. And this is a picture of our Bottle County Training School. And people came from all around to go to school here. That's why the large houses were built in Mound Bayou, because people used to stay with other people in Mound Bayou as well. And, of course, here's a picture of one of the physicians in Mound Bayou. The first brick church built in Bottle County was First Baptist Church. And it was first called Green Grove Baptist Church, and before that, it was a brush arbor. It was where the people finally came to Mound Bayou, got off the train, and built a brush arbor where they can say they can worship God freely. And coming out of that was this First Baptist Church, and it is a majestic church here now in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Of course, you know we celebrate the bank building here at Mound Bayou, which is not far from me, right around the corner there, which was built and it was organized and opened in 1904. And then that structure there was later on built as well. And it was the headquarters for many other It was the headquarters for many other, the bank building was the headquarters for many other organizations here in Mound Bay as well. But this is one of the things that we applaud, and that is that the Mound Bay Oil Mill and Manufacturing Company was opened here in Mound Bay in 1912. And that oil mill was one of the, it was the first undertaking of this size of African Americans anywhere in this country. And here's a picture of all these. I look at this picture, and I'd love to look at this picture over and over again. It was thousands of African Americans came during the opening of this oil mill, and you see these pictures of these men in these suits and their hats. And for me, that is a powerful, powerful picture in Mississippi. And these men, it was more than 16,000 people attending when Booker T. Washington in 1912 opened the oil and dedicated that oil mill in November 1912. So goes Mound Bay. This is it. This is where we are. This is a great place in African American history.
All right, Mount Bayou and New Philadelphia. New Philadelphia is a ghost place now, but it's on the historic registry. But it's started by a former slave, and I guess generational wealth, his descendants just didn't keep the town going. However, Mount Bayou is still going on strong. And we've had at least two people on this podcast that are from Mount Bayou. And Pleasant Stephens' wife, I believe, is from Mount Bayou, Mississippi. He's been down there himself. Now, give a little interesting factoid. Because one, reparations looks, it's different from different people. But many people, I don't know the percentage, that are looking at getting reparations from the federal government or even these little local governments, I say they're counting the white man's money. Now, here's something interesting. It came from Mount Bayou. You know what? Hold on. Before you even go to that, Frank McWhorter started New Philadelphia, and that's the first documented township that was started or founded by a black person here in the United States who just happened to be born a slave. Frank McWhorter, he purchased 80 acres of land. He purchased 80 acres of land. He purchased it from the federal government. The government did not give him anything. Frank had to come up with his own $100. Now, he did that in 1830. Now, we get an inflation calculator, which I have one. $100 in 1830 today is valued at $2,953.22. So essentially, Frank had to come up, well, in today's dollars, he bought 80 acres of land, $2,953.22. All right. Now, the lowest I've ever been able to do so far is $200 an acre. But I've known some people that have bought an acre for $100, $100 per acre. But in any event, he purchased 80 acres. The government didn't give him anything. He had to buy it. He bought those 80 acres. Then he had it platted out and sold 144 acres to both black and white people. It was an integrated town. And according to my definition of reparations, that was Frank McWhorter's reparations. Once again, they're 24 hours in a day. We're all equal. As long as we're living, as long as we're among the living, we're all equal when it comes to the asset called time. Once you step off that, the equality thing goes out the window. Now, Mount Bayou, Mississippi, let me give you a little interesting factoid about that. And I'm going to see if I can get the wife or one of either the wife of Mega Rappers or one of his children. Let me see if I can get him on this podcast for a live stream. Mega Evers in 1952, Mega Evers moved to Mount Bayou, Mississippi to sell insurance for Howard's Magnolia Mutual Life Insurance Company. And what's interesting, because I want to find out, why did Mega Evers move from Mount Bayou, Mississippi to Jackson, Mississippi, where he got killed? He was in, I don't want to speculate, but he was in Mount Bayou, black town, no problems, no racial stuff going on. But then he and his family moved to Jackson, Mississippi, which at that time, you got the KKK and lynchings and all this other stuff. Why did he move from, and you know the story how they killed him. They killed him on his front lawn in front of his family. So I want to contact the family and possibly have at least one of the family, hopefully his wife, his widow, if not one of the kids. I would like to find out why he moved from a safe environment. And once again, Mount Bayou, not only the people that founded the town, but even the people that moved to the town of Mount Bayou, that's their form of reparations. The government didn't come up with the concept of Mount Bayou. Former slaves did. Anyway, but I'm gonna see if I can track down Marilee Evers or one of her children. Because I would like to ask them that question. Why move? And I don't want to speculate. Why did you move from a peaceful environment to a hostile environment? Because soon after Mega Evers was assassinated, his widow packed up the family and she ended up out on the West Coast. In any event, now going back to Frank McWhorter, and this is why we're going to have a reparations. We'll probably start off with a reparations day once a month to start off until we go. We had to build up to once a week because if a former slave can buy their freedom and buy the freedom of other family members who were born legally as slaves. And in 1890, that former slave, without no assistance from the government, without social services, without no federal aid, state aid, city that can go out and purchase their own 80 acres. Mind you, he didn't have no internet connection, no smartphone, no tablet, no desktop, no laptop computers. No internet connection. If Frank McWhorter can do that in 1830, which is, once again, according to my definition of reparations, get his reparations that way, then, okay, and here's why I'm establishing Reparations Day. Well, it might be 40 acres day. I don't know how I'm going to word it up yet. Well, we'll start it next month, though, first week of next month. Because I'm betting that you as an individual can purchase 40 acres of land before you'll get 40 acres or any type of reparations from the federal government. Anyway, I just got that idea today. Like I said, we're going to launch it the first week in September. We'll probably start it off once a month. And you'll have, you know, you just want to see where, and I'm not selling you anything. We'll tell you where to go. We'll tell you where to go find this stuff. And some of you might purchase a quarter acre. Some of you might purchase a half acre. But if you, and different strokes for different folks. Some people might want to do it every month. Some every other month. Some might want to do it, you know, if you just purchased, let's say, an acre a year. When you did that for 10 years, and, well, in 10 years, you've got, you know, 10 acres. Because the thing is, an acre of land is quite a bit of land, a bit of land. So before you buy, you need to know what you're going to do with it, you know, where you need a partner, you know, what kind of land you're going to purchase. So we want to have an educational component in it. We just don't want you to just go out and blindly buy, because we're not selling you any land. But when you do buy it on your own through your own education, you need to know, you know, what are you going to do with it? Because it's like it's really, really easy to purchase 100 acres. Actually, the larger, the more tracts of acreages that you want to purchase, is really easier to get. From my experience, but here's where the problem I ran into. It might be easy to buy, but then you got to deal with management. Okay, what are you going to do with that acre or acres? So it's real easy to get 100 acres. However, probably going to need some partners. Like I was thinking in my case, you know what, if I had 100 acres, I would need bare minimum 10 partners, and then it would have to be 10 partners that can manage 10 acres of land. And like I said, acres of football field, that's quite a bit of land. So we're going to have the 40-acre club, I don't know what we're going to call it yet, but the object is, who can get 40 acres or accumulate any amount of acreages before, I mean, is it quick, you know, while other people, because you got other people waiting on the government to give them something. Let's go to phone lines real quick. 314, your mic is open.
What do you say, L.A.?
How you doing?
Well, you know, I'm always countering people's claims on things the same way that they do. They say that the story is not told.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they tell the story is not completely told, right?
I agree.
Yeah, because when you talk about Mississippi belonged to the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, and the Navajo. Amongst the Mississippians, the Tuskegeeans, the Biloxi, all those was Indian tribe. Did you know that?
I did not know about the Tuskegee. I went to that
Tuskegee's
college. I didn't know they had a tribe.
Yeah, Tuskegee's an Indian tribe.
Okay.
Biloxi's an Indian tribe.
Did not know.
You know
that?
You know how they want to change the name of the baseball team?
Uh-huh.
From the Cleveland Indians?
Yeah, or the Washington Redskins, which is now the Washington team.
Well, damn hell, let's change the name of Biloxi. Let's change the name of Tuskegee. Let's change the name of Natchez. You got a Natchez, Louisiana. The fork in the road.
Tuskegee Indians, you done woke me up to something this morning. I visited that campus some time ago, and I did not know that the Tuskegee is a tribe of Indians.
Oh, absolutely. It's a tribe of Indians. And that was Indian land. So, as I've always counted, how in the heck were you going to have 40 acres and it was Indian land? That's one of the reasons why the president at that time didn't go along with what Sherman and Secretary of Defense Stanton talked about.
Well, that's a vital piece of information that I haven't heard anybody mention before.
Well, I think people know. They're just waiting for the right time to bring it out. Like when you get some money in your pocket. You say, wait a minute, now you got to pay me for this land. This ain't none of your land.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? Well, let's talk about it.
Mm.
And you were talking about Emmett Till. There's some history of that, too, that we don't know about. And I tell you, somebody who do know, because they interviewed the relatives of his uncles. And that's Carrie Hines. You know her? She's got a show.
I've heard the name.
A blog talk show. Yeah, she interviewed the people there who are relatives of his uncles. And you should listen to the story that they tell.
I have to start listening to her then.
Well, you can contact her. She could probably arrange it to get those people on the show if they ain't dead. This is several years ago. So, what I'm saying is that the narrative that's out there, like the lady said, that Africans was put on boats. Well, that ain't just kind of like the way that happened. And if we're going to have a topic along the lines that they want to call critical race theory for what it is, then let's tell the story completely how these things happened and came to be about. Actually, the natives in those areas of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, they go back over 10,000 years. Wasn't no slaves coming from West Africa over 10,000 years ago, right?
Yeah. They've been here for a while.
And guess what? When they came, somebody else was here before them. Called the Taino, and those that was down in South America. So they took it from them. So to say the settlers took the Native American land, well, who did the Native Americans take it from? This can go on and on and on.
Yeah, people are selective about their start date or how far they go back.
Now, I agree with the lady that it would be nice to turn that into a tourist area, but you need to include the native, the Indian tribes too. Because if you don't, then you're just doing what others, you claim others have done. They have clothing, jewelry, song, food. That's all indigenous to that area. Art. Just like in Illinois, the Cahokia, Illinois. That's named after the Cahokians, who was part of the Mississippians, because Cahokia Mounds there on Route 3, right outside of, let's see, what is Cahokia, Illinois, right outside of East St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
going toward, I can't think of the name of that city. That there is a, that's a big mound. We used to go up on that mound. Either just playing around or for some occasion. Plus, there's a lot of little mounds around it. But that overlooks the, you can't see the Mississippi River because Highway 55 runs to the north, I guess you could say, of that mound. But when you're up on that mound, it's a pretty tall mound. It's just dirt piled up on each other.
Mm-hmm.
We had a mound in our community. Their Cote is called Cote Brillante. It's on Cote Brilliant and Kings Highway and Martin Luther King. We used to be Easton. We used to play ball up there on that mound. They still do, but people don't know it's an Indian mound. Brillante is a... I think it's a French word, which means shining hill.
Okay. Well, I'm fascinated with, I'm looking at the Biloxi people.
It talks about the Biloxi tribe?
Yeah, the Biloxi tribe. Man, okay. Well, I'll be I got to do a podcast on this one soon.
So that's what come I be telling you, when these people talking about reparations and stuff, they basing this off of these stories and these claims and this hoopla is based off of a bunch of emotion. There's no thought and consideration going into this. First thing they're going to say is a white man did this, white man did that. Well, get to looking into it a little bit more closely and see who all the claims were.
You know what? I'm gonna do more research. And thank you for bringing that up because that changes the whole dynamic of reparations.
Yeah, like they be naming off who all got reparations, and they making mention of the Indians. That wasn't no reparations. That was payment for them releasing slaves, and also probably some payments for the land that the government bought from them.
Right.
Before they went out to Indian territory, which was now Oklahoma. So even in the thing, too, some of those areas out there that they say they farm, because the Creek Indians were pretty wealthy. Some of them was wealthy. I mean, it's just same like any group of people. You got those who do very good, those who are mediocre, and those who are marginal.
Right.
But the Creek had some. Had some what you would call at that time wealthy people, and a lot of them with black skin. Like the lady said, these are truly Negroes. Remember when she said that?
Yeah.
That was during the Seminole War against the U.S. government, the army. Those weren't Negroes. Those were Indians that just so happened to have dark skin because of their breeding with Africans.
Right.
And to let you know, there was no African Americans because at the treaty, I think it was the Treaty of Paris, I'm not sure, when the government said that the Indians could become American citizens, they said, no, we don't want to become American citizens. We like where it is. I guess they looked at the way blacks was being treated in Mississippi. But, you know, in Mississippi, It might have been Mississippi. It might have been Carolina. I think it was Mississippi. They had a law against mistreating slaves. Matter of fact, your slaves was treated worse in the Choctaw and the Chickasaw nations than they were in Mississippi. Because in Mississippi, you couldn't just outright kill your slave for anything.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at, I want to do more research on what you're just talking about, because I'm looking at, if I was a slave master, I'm looking at a slave as an investment. So,
well, that's basically what it was. It was, it, it was,
yeah,
for work.
Investments. Yeah.
Yeah.
To help me.
They didn't build the country.
Build up wealth.
Because some cases,
so
those people got paid.
It's not to my benefit to maim or injure or kill an investment. Because once that asset is, I'm looking, you know what, I'm sort of like looking at, because I did, it was yesterday. I'm looking at slaves, now this is crazy L.A.'s thinking, slaves as the geese that laid the golden egg. If I kill a slave, I won't get no more golden eggs.
No,
so,
you wouldn't.
I'm looking at, you know, we hear about a lot of horrific stories about what happened to slaves, and a lot of that did happen. But I'm sure there were many other stories where the plantation owners looked at them as investments, because some of these plantations had schools on.
Well, yeah, blacks was. And see, here's the thing: blacks was plantation owners. You had black plantation owners too. You had mulatto plantation owners also back during that time for what the term meant. You know, when a black man or a white black male or white male bred with a black woman or white male, white woman, well, that offspring was called a mulatto. And a lot of them could pass. You had one, I can't name, think of her name right now. She was a poet at that time. She wrote the book about the Ethiopians. Wonderful Ethiopians, the ancient Kushite Empire. I think that's the one she wrote. Well, she was a mulatto. She wrote a poem, something like, "Oh Lord, wash my heart as white as snow," or something like that. But actually, the majority of your slaveholders, a large portion of slaveholders, were women down in the New Orleans area.
Well, I know the one that, I don't know if she owned slaves, Mother Priscilla Baltimore, she was mulatto and started Brooklyn, Illinois, or helped found Brooklyn, Illinois, which is also known as Lovejoy, Illinois today.
Well, Brooklyn, Illinois was one of the towns that came about. Might have had some influence from President Nixon. Brooklyn, Illinois, nothing today. And it's, Lovejoy is different from Brooklyn. It's not the same as Brooklyn, Illinois.
Oh, it's not the same? Okay, I thought they were both different. Okay. Too far from you, isn't it? Hello? Oh, wait, this blog talk. Okay, well, I don't know. This blog talk's tripping. All right, anyway, we ran over time. Anyway, tomorrow, you know, we're going to pick back up on this. Reparations, a shakedown strategy. Learn something new today. The Tuskegee Indians and the Biloxi Indians and the other tribes as well. That puts a different look at reparations because... Man, that opens up a whole different can of worms. The Indians were sitting on it before the federal government. So if anything, shouldn't the land go right back to the Biloxi tribe or the Tuskegee tribe? On that note, we'll cover that tomorrow.